1320 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Seven jurors are seated in former President Donald Trump's Manhattan criminal trial involving alleged hush money payments and the falsifying of business records. CBS's Robert Costa.
The Trump lawyers spent a lot of time looking at the social media posts of some of these potential jurors, wondering, have they posted anything that could be perceived as biased against Trump?
The House of Representatives sends its articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate, where the future of a potential trial is up in the air. Republican Congressman Mark Green.
During Alejandro and Mayorkas' tenure as Secretary of Homeland Security, U.S. Border Patrol has encountered an increasing number of aliens on the terrorist watch list.
Severe weather with the possibility of tornadoes in the forecast overnight for southern Iowa into northern Missouri and west central Illinois. Matt Elliott with the National Weather Service.
Really focusing tomorrow on portions of eastern Indiana, northern Ohio, and then kind of southeast Michigan.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Seth here, host of Over the Back Fence. We're on the air live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., taking your calls to buy or sell, talk local events, or whatever, only on WFHR.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. If you're living with diabetes and on Medicare, the Inflation Reduction Act caps your out-of-pocket insulin costs at $35 a month. But for many other Americans, the cost of insulin is still expensive.
Only three companies are able to control basically the global supply of insulin. And in the United States, that means that there are unaffordable costs.
Catherine Poe is a policy researcher. Wisconsin is not one of the 25 states that cap insulin copays. Two scenic highways in Wisconsin are now part of the state's Rustic Roads program. The first stretch covers almost 10 miles near the American Birkebeiner Trail in northwest Wisconsin. The other new route crosses Honey Creek near East Troy and passes what was once a one-room schoolhouse. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids home of Nightlight with Peach Schwabba.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Monday was an historic day. Major history made on Monday. It was Billionaire Appreciation Day, obviously. And thank you, billionaires, for putting our sacrifice put to good use. The sacrifices in wage increases and healthcare and retirement security and our economic well-being. Thank you for using those sacrifices to good use, like making yourself wealthier. So at least we can brag about the fact that we've created something. yeah, that was it. but Monday also marked the first time ever in the history of the country that a former president has been compelled to stand trial for criming. He's the first. This is the first, and he'll be soon the second. And then he'll be the third, and then he'll be the fourth. So he'll hold the top four spots of presidents going to trial. And I thought it was interesting on day one. Obviously, you're going to go through the boring legal stuff of jury selection, all that. But the entertainment of it was not lost on social media, where evidently, according to Maggie Haberman, the reporter from the New York Times, Donald Trump nodded off a couple of times. How did she put it? You know, closed his eyes, got slack-jawed. And immediately the social medias went nuts. There were AI pictures of Trump sleeping. I put one of them out. I shared some of it, yes. But I thought some of the names were fun. Sleepy Don, not very creative, but to the point. Rip Van Stinkle was interesting. Don Snorleone, one of my favorites, and also the Nodfather. And I'm going to go with the Nodfather because I think it's hysterical. Now, what's interesting, and the reason I bring this up and the why I think it's important is, didn't hear the Red Hat Brigade losing their mind. Because if Biden had done that, if he had fallen asleep, they'd be making memes everywhere. There would be memes, there would be mocking, there would be calls for resignations. They would be, look, Marjorie Three Names and her crowd would want to impeach. There would be craziness, but not a peep out of the cult with Trump nodding off. Now, to me, that means nothing, because look, I got to tell you, the guy's under a lot of strain, a lot of stress. Running for president's tough. Juggling 4 criminal indictments, that's got to be tough too, especially when you did it, and then you got to be worrying about, hey, am I going to jail? He's not going to jail. Understand? I don't care if he's found guilty on all of them. I don't see them locking him up, but you know, we'll see. Now, I do find it interesting. The folks over at Wired.com had a really good story about Truth Social, because Trump's major influx of cash is, for him, he hopes, is going to be this Truth Social. Because when it went public, when the IPO hit, man, it billions. I think it was like $7 billion valuation of Truth Social, even though last year it only had revenue, not profit, revenue of $4 million. And look, I don't know a lot. I'm not the greatest mathematician, but I think $7 billion is a bit overvalued for a company that brought in $4 million. Just a little. And why, it explains why it's lost almost half its value in just about a month. And why they're calling it a meme stock. Why that the valuation has no ties to reality. Other than it's the cult, and they have a cult of personality. Now, the company, Trump Media and Technology Group, the parent company of Truth Social, they doth filed a document with the Securities and Exchange Commission, as all corporations do, talking about their risks. It's so that shareholders know what's going on. That if you bother to read it, you can find out, you know, what the company's worried about, what lawsuits they have, all this stuff. And evidently, Truth Social got a number of lawsuits, especially by former employees. A lot of those. But I found it interesting that they pointed out, along with their several risks, that aren't related directly to Trump, you know, like competition from other you know, the Twitters and the Gabs and the Rumbles and, you know, whatever else is out there. Obviously, that's a risk. I love the fact that the deficiencies in bookkeeping and accounting was a risk, given the fact that, well, there have been some accounting irregularities in other Trump companies. And then they said, you know, look, you know, data privacy laws could affect us. And that makes sense. But they went even further. Yeah, they looked at their dear leader, who owns more than half, obviously, of the 21.5 million shares. They looked at him as the risk. And they had to say, look, you know, there are ways Trump could threaten the value of the meme stock. Because I got to tell you, who would spend money on this, knowing it only had $4 million in revenue? That's crazy money. They're chasing nothing. But they said, look, you know, and laying out in this document, said, look, Trump's got some real legal issues. You know, they said, you know, if Trump were to discontinue his relationship with the Trump Media and Technology Group due to, you know, death, disability, criminal convictions, incarceration or other reason, or limited involvement, due to his ongoing candidacy for political office, the company would be at a significant disadvantage, because he's really the only one on there. The only reason I have an account and other people have accounts, I think, is just to see what insanity comes off his fingers. That's it. He goes away, Truth Social bails, because they don't even get that. They also pointed out his past with filing bankruptcy. You knew that had to come back and bite him. The fact that there are a lot of companies that refuse to do anything with Truth Social, got some problems that third-party partners, don't want to deal with them. And, you know, Trump's use of other platforms. You know, they're concerned that, hey, you know, he's running for president. He might use something else, you know, like the book over there with the face and the other ones, the X thing, the Twitter thing with the Musk. And they say, look, you know, Trump's got this radical self-interest. Remember, he owns more than 50%. I think it's 57.6. Where they write, President Donald J. Trump will, as controlling stockholder, be entitled to vote his shares in his own interests, which may not always be in the interest of the stockholders generally. What? What? Call me shocked that they're concerned that somebody's actually concerned that Donald Trump will act in his best interest and stick it to everyone else. Wow. But here again, they have to file this. They have to legally file this because a lot of shareholders could turn around and go, well, we didn't know that Donald Trump was going to tank his own stock. We didn't know that your company was so reliant on one guy. So they're just basically laying out, hey, it's a house of cards. And our guy could be the one who knocks them all over. And, you know, if he does get convicted, and he does, you know, and I know there are a lot of people hoping he goes to jail. I don't think it's ever going to happen. But if he does go to jail, I don't think they're going to let him take his phone with him. I don't think he's going to have Twitter time. Now, I got to tell you, I would lobby heavily for him to have thumb time. Just to see the craziness that comes out. There could be novels and books that come out of that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser is going to be here to share some thoughts on what our Supreme Court, what the Trump Supreme Court hath in store for America. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, our U.S. Supreme Court decided that it will not hear this McKesson versus Doe case. Their decision allows the lower court ruling to stand. And you go, well, what does that mean? Even if I'm reading this right, my labor friends, you may have a problem. Because basically, if I'm getting this right, it eliminates the right of, well, people to organize a mass protest in places like Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. And it's just those three states, I guess, for right now. But I got to wonder, is this going to come to a red state near you? And here to share some thoughts on, well, how bad this is, or what it is, I've asked our good friend Ian Millhiser to come talk with us. Ian's a senior correspondent over at Vox, Vox.com. He's got a new piece out on this. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much, Rick.
So what is this? Who is this McKesson? What is the basis of this? What happened?
Yeah. So DeRay McKesson, he is a fairly prominent figure in the Black Lives Matter movement. He organized a protest, you know, several years ago down in Baton Rouge after there was a police shooting. And the rule has always been that this goes back to a decision called Claiborne from 1982, that if you organize a protest, you are not liable if someone who shows up at the protest does something bad, because otherwise you just couldn't have a protest. You know, if I invite 5,000 people to a protest, I'm not going to be able to control all of these thousands of people and make sure that none of them does something wrong. And the Fifth Circuit, which is the most conservative federal appeals court in the country, basically just read Claiborne out of the law. They said that essentially because the protesters violated a traffic law, because they like went into the street when they weren't supposed to go into the street, that negates their First Amendment rights. That negates DeRay's First Amendment right to organize this protest. And therefore, what happened is one of the protest attendees, we don't know who, did something terrible. They threw a rock at a cop, and they should not have done that. If we could find out who that person is, they should be prosecuted for it. But, you know, DeRay didn't do that. No one else at the protest did it. And so if you take away the organizer's ability to organize the protest, if you make him liable for the action of this one person, no one in their right mind is ever going to organize a protest again, because, you know, you're going to bankrupt yourself if you organize a protest again, because one person can ruin it all for you.
No, and the thing is, you know, one person throws a rock, you don't even know if that person was attached to that that protest. And I go back to, you know, the Haymarket affair, you know, 1887. So how far back in the law are we, you know, how far back are we rewriting that? I mean, because I think of the Haymarket affair, and, you know, we don't know who threw the bomb. We don't know who started the chaos and the riot. But, you know, from that point forward, if this ruling's in place, none of the other protests, none of the labor organizing, none of the civil rights organizing, none of that stuff happens then.
No, that's exactly right, because, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, we don't know who the person was who threw the rock in this case. We don't know whose side they were on. We don't know if there was a counter protester. Actually, the dissenting judge in the Fifth Circuit pointed out, you know, under the Fifth Circuit's decision, someone who opposes the goals of the protest can show up, throw a rock, and then the organizer of the protest winds up having to pay a bunch of money for it. You know, a Ku Klux Klansman could show up to a Black Lives Matter rally. Or for that matter, like, if you're having a picket line outside of a place of business, management can hire someone to smash a few windows, and now the union is liable for these smashed windows. You know, again, it makes no sense to say, when you don't even know who the person is who committed the criminal act, that the organizer of the protest is responsible for it.
No, it's financially responsible. It's not like they're going to try this person for throwing the rock. This is all about money, as I understand.
Yeah, that's right. It's a civil lawsuit. So, you know, DeRay isn't going to get thrown in prison in this case. And like in the case involving the union, you know, the union organizers aren't going to get thrown in prison. But still, like, you know, we're potentially talking about a whole lot of money here. I mean, you know, I've attended protesters before where, like, I mean, if you know about the Black Bloc, they're a bunch of anarchists who like to show up at protests and start smashing things. And, you know, no one who organizes legitimate protesters likes that folk, those folks, because, you know, they bring a bad name to the legitimate protest. Now they could lead to the protest organizers getting charged. You know, you could have counter protesters, you could have intentional provocateurs, you could have, you know, someone hired by management showing up at a labor protest. You could have, you know, someone hired by the police showing up at a protest, you know, protesting the police. You could have someone in the Klan show up, you know, whoever is on the other side of the protest can, you know, can show up, can commit an illegal act. And the people in charge of the protest now are out, you know, they could be impoverished because of it.
You know, I look at this and I go, you know, elections matter. This mostly because, one, you know, you had Mitch McConnell, who was able to steal a Supreme Court justice seat by not allowing a vote on Merrick Garland or even a hearing. And then, two, you've got, you know, Trump, who put three of the most extreme people on the Supreme Court. This is the kind of stuff we get. And to me, it seems like the groundwork is being laid towards an authoritarian kind of situation. I'm not going to say dictatorship yet, but it seems like we're moving in the direction where we're silencing people rather quickly, especially people we don't necessarily care too much about.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, this case would have never have been taken seriously. You know, Justice Anthony Kennedy, you know, he's a moderate Republican. He wasn't our friend, but like he believed in the First Amendment. You know, he believed that that people have a right to go out and protest the government if they want to. You know, I mean, I guess I should note that this isn't the final resolution of this case. The Supreme Court didn't endorse the crazy thing that the Fifth Circuit said, but the Fifth Circuit's ruling stands, and the Fifth Circuit has jurisdiction over Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. So if you want to protest the government in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, I don't know what to tell you right now beyond don't, because like, you're if you organize a protest in one of those three states, you're putting yourself in an extraordinary amount of danger.
Isn't that, won't that eventually be the point, though, that someone's going to have to do that? That there's going to have to be some kind of standing by someone to be able to challenge this and take it to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Supreme Court is eventually going to reverse the Fifth Circuit. But it's the same sort of thing we're seeing in the Trump criminal trial right now, where timing matters. You know, I know DeRay, who's the defendant in this case. And he's, I mean, this thing has been going on for years now. And I mean, he's fortunate that the ACLU is representing him, but most people aren't going to be able to get a nonprofit to, you know, to represent him. They're going to have to be paying out their own pocket. And years of litigation will bankrupt you just as surely as losing a lawsuit is. I mean, you know, if you're in a union, you know, how much money does your union have to defend that? And, you know, if they're spending that money on lawyers, that's money they can't spend on organizing. That's money that they can't spend on a strike fund. If you need a strike fund, so timing matters. It's the same thing we're seeing in the Trump trial where, you know, I don't think they're going to say in this Trump immunity case that's being argued next week that Donald Trump is allowed to do crimes. I just don't think they're going to say that. But by what they did in that case is they said, we're going to put Trump's D.C. trial on hold until we figure out if he's allowed to do crimes.
Right.
So, you know, they've probably delayed the case until after the election. So, you know, that's kind of how this court operates. You know, they don't always hand down a decision that does the worst possible thing, but often they manipulate the timing of when things happen so that they get the outcome that they want.
Yeah, there are no profiles in courage there is what you're saying.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
And you know, what's frustrating in this is, you know, the reason I bring up the labor part of this, because a lot of my labor friends are looking at, you know, a Trump presidency and with great anticipation. And I'm like, do you not remember the 4 years that he was there? Do you not know that he's the reason that the public sector is under assault the way it is because of the people he put on the court who decided the Janus case? You not see this kind of stuff that is targeted at you and organizations like yours? Do you not get that? And I don't know that they do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the Janus case. I mean, we just had the Glacier Northwest case come down, which said like, oh no, you did a strike and it cost the company some money when you struck. That's the point of a strike. Like that, the whole point of a strike is that, you know, the company depends on the labor showing up and doing their job. And if they don't do their job, it costs the company money. That is the leverage that the union has. And if you start to say, oh, the union's not allowed to impose costs on management, you know, what you're doing is you're stripping the union of all of its power.
And for me, I don't know how much more you can go. Look at what they're doing. You know, don't listen to the words. Look at what's happening. And this is another one of those things that's happening. They tell us how much they love the First Amendment and you know, how much they love free speech. And yet, well, I guess it depends on who you are, because I don't know that I got to wonder, you know, how would this play with the January 6th folks?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a case this week about the January 6th folk where they could like throw out charges against 300 different January 6th defendants if they read one of the statutes they've been charged under fairly narrowly. I mean, I think the thing you have to understand about how the Republican Party is operating right now, I mean, Trump has sort of been hemming and hawing about abortion, and he's gotten around to saying, yeah, no, I'm not going to sign an abortion ban. And I actually believe him. And the reason why I believe him is because the way that the Republican Party makes laws now is they don't push it through Congress. They appoint judges who will do the things that they want. So, like, Trump isn't going to sign the abortion ban. He's going to appoint judges who are going to ban abortion. You know, look what just happened in Arizona. Look what just happened in Florida. You know, Florida has a provision in its constitution which says very, very explicitly there's a right to privacy. That's the language that the Supreme Court used in Roe v. Wade. There's a right to privacy. You know, it was a bunch of DeSantis appointees on the state Supreme Court. They didn't care. Out in Arizona, the legislature passed a law a few years ago saying that abortion is banned at 15 weeks. Now, you know, I don't like that law, but they set a time frame. They said 15 weeks, and the state Supreme Court comes in and says, no, it's banned altogether. It's banned at 0 weeks. You know, that's not what the legislature said. So, again, like, the thing that I worry about is that I think that Republicans are tricking a lot of people because they're saying, oh, we're not going to sign this law. We're not going to put this law through the legislature. And sometimes they're telling the truth. But the reason they're telling the truth is they don't need to. They know that their judges are going to do it for them.
And again, this is why elections matter on a certain level. Yeah, who you put into positions of power to put people into positions of power, why that matters. And look, I don't think the left or Democrats have done a good enough job explaining how important the courts are, even after all of this. And look, I remember the election of 2016. I remember handing out leaflets for a friend who was running for a state House seat here. And virtually everyone I talked to said, look, I don't like Trump so much, but this is all about the Supreme Court. They knew what they were there for. They were there to take over the courts because they had done the groundwork. They had done the organizing that it takes to make people aware of what the game is.
Right. And I mean, I want to be fair to people who are confused by everything that's going on right now, because like they are trying to intentionally confuse us. Like, one frustrating thing I've heard from some voters, and I mean, I've seen some voters quoted in the press saying this, is that they're mad at Biden because Roe v. Wade was overruled on Biden's watch. And yeah, it was overruled on Biden's watch, but Trump put the people on the court that got rid of Roe v. Wade. I sometimes try to remind myself, you know, I follow politics for a living. It's my job. And so I know all these nuances. You know, when you're working and, like, you know, your job doesn't require you to pay attention to politics, you've got a family to take care of and you've got all the obligations you got, and you maybe have enough time to catch 5 minutes of the news every now and then. It's tough to follow all this stuff when, like, you know, Trump does something in 2018 that leads to something happening in 2022 when we have an entirely different president. Like, I understand how normal, you know, ordinary people aren't weird like me and follow politics for a living, how they can be confused by that. But this is an intentional strategy that Republicans are running to, you know, use their judges so we don't know who's responsible for what's going on.
No, you're spot on accurate. And sadly, our education system really hasn't reinforced what our system of government is and how all these things work as well as I would like them to. Because as you pointed out, you know, these justices were appointed by somebody else. The court is, you know, independent. We've got three branches, that whole balancing thing, but it doesn't seem like it's balancing. So the last line of question I've got for you, because I know some people are going to look at this decision, this McKesson decision, and go, well, good, because it's the Black Lives Matter folks. It's people that have, well, especially if you're on the right, you've been trained to not like. Think they're all criminals and they're all blowing things up. And this is going to be good for public safety. They're no longer going to burn down cities, which I'm told happens all the time. But it's never going to affect me. Right. Does this eventually trickle down to where the folks who are looking at this going, good, it's about time we go after those people? Does it eventually affect them?
Well, I mean, the thing about constitutional rights is that they only count if they apply to everyone. They only work if they apply to everyone. And that means they have to apply to the absolute worst people you could possibly think of. You know, the ACLU famously defended a Nazi march.
Oh, they defended Rush Limbaugh.
Exactly. You know, there's a case in front of the court that was just argued recently where they defended the NRA. And the reason why is because the ACLU understands that the First Amendment only works if everyone has it. You know, once you start saying this person's too bad, they don't get free speech. Well, once you open the door to that, you know, it's only up to the judges to decide whether you get it or not. And if you look at the judges we've got right now, you know, do you want Sam Alito deciding who is good enough for free speech. You know, the only way to prevent a world where people like that are deciding who gets to speak and who has to stay silent is we just say everyone gets to speak.
Yeah. Well, if you listen to Trump and his Red Hat Brigade, they all believe that they're being silenced, that they're being censored, that they're the victims. I mean, they are the one thing that they do masterfully. They play the victim card.
They do. They're extraordinarily good at it. And, you know, again, the only thing, you know, if Trump wants to say something, he should be allowed to say it. But, you know, we cannot have this situation where we are losing rights because, you know, Trump appoints someone and then we don't know who is responsible for it when something terrible happens, you know, 3 or 4 years later.
Yeah, and also you create a system where our judicial system is no longer blind and the thumb is actually on the scale. But Ian, I appreciate the time. Always good stuff coming out of you over at Vox. So folks will take a look at it, Vox.com, the website. Ian Millhiser, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Does it matter? If it's like Ian says, even if it's the worst of us, should we be protecting even that? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Showers, still some storms in the overnight. Some of that rain locally heavy. Temperatures dropping to the upper 40s. It will stay breezy with east winds gusting over 40 miles per hour. On Wednesday, showers and storms still likely. Highs in the lower 60s. Winds turning to the west. Right now, it's 48.
The Todd Alba Show.
Who do you want making the decisions for your daughters if you're a girl dad? I have two girls, 14 and 12, and I still consider myself pro-life. But here's the thing. I became a conservative because I didn't want government telling me what to do and being intrusive in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'll be damned if I want a bunch of theocrats getting in the middle of my daughter's life.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, it's frustrating when you see stories like this come out. Last Friday, I happened to see a story about the Mack truck folks are looking at building a plant in Mexico. In fact, you know, they announced it on Thursday. Friday, I see the story. I'm angered. I'm frustrated because, look, these guys fought for a good contract. The good conditions. This is a group of workers at UAW Local 677 and other places who fought to keep this company afloat. And now the thanks they get is, hey, we've decided we're gonna build the plant that we need, not here locally, not in the U.S., but in Mexico. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, how, why, where, what, all that, I've asked Tim Herzog to come talk with us. Tim is a committee man and the elected shop chair with UAW Local 677. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having us.
So, you know, I saw your comment. This is a slap in the face. I can't put it any better than that. This appears to me to be a slap in the face and a giant screw you for getting a good contract.
100%. That message that I put out was pretty much straight from the heart. We had all of about 15 minutes from the time we were told to the time it was going to go public. And my guys scrambled to get the message out. The way things typically go here is the company tells the media, and our folks read it on the media, and then we end up looking terrible. So we got it out. But yeah, it's a slap in the face, man. We walked the picket lines for 6 weeks. We finally got what we thought was a fair deal. And here we are 6 months later. Oh, by the way, we're going to start a plant in Mexico.
Now, you know, as I'm looking into this, you know, I think of Mack Trucks as, you know, an iconic American company. I think of this as an iconic American brand, you know, something my grandfather, you know, drove back in the day. When you think truck, you know, there's Freightliner, there's Peterbilt, there's Mack. I mean, to me, this idea that you can make it anywhere but here, I don't know how to square that.
Neither do we, Rick. We're working closely with local representatives to purchase 220 acres within a few miles of this current plant, which is within a couple miles of our main warehouse. It all made sense, but apparently our labor is too expensive.
Is that what this is about, do you think? This is purely about the fact that you guys got a decent contract, that you're sharing in the profit that your wealth creates, and they don't like it? I mean, is that it?
I honestly can't think of any other reason. I mean, they're going to build a plant in Mexico. They're saying it's only for our overflow work. But again, yeah, that's going to take away our bargaining power. But you're getting labor that is, you know, $5 to $10 an hour for entry level to skilled manufacturing labor. Poor work standards. You don't have to worry about any kind of work standards, health care. I mean,
this is a race to the bottom. It is what it is. It's a race to the bottom. When you say this is overflow, this seems to be the argument that every company makes as they're exiting the country, going, no, we're just going, you know, just in case when things, you know, when we have too much work, you know, it's not going to affect, you know, people who are here today. And then a couple years down the line, you find either they've closed those plants because, hey, they're making more money over there, or they've destroyed the golden goose. By taking another iconic American brand to be made overseas by cheap, exploitable, unskilled labor, and boom, now you got a bunch of crap.
So I truly understand that we're going to outgrow Mukunji. You know, if we want to get the market share back that we had, you have to build 200 trucks a day. This plant was designed when it opened in 75. They thought the maximum was in the 50 range. We're at 128. We have room to put another second shift on, which would add another 20 trucks to our cab overs. But we're tapped out then. But the plan was to keep that in the valley, or at least stateside, to take an iconic brand, an American brand, something that's, you know, like Harley Davidson stuff. Nobody says built like a Freightliner. They say it's built like a Mack truck. It's part of who we are. And now they want to take that and take it to Mexico. Like, it's just tarnishing the brand.
Now, obviously, not going to take this lying down. I'm sure that your union is looking how to respond to this. I got to think the way forward on this is saying, look, this is an iconic American brand. You know, me personally, I'm tired of seeing foreign corporations take over companies like Mack, like other iconic brands, and then run them into the ground so that they can have short-term profits that they then take elsewhere, where they basically suck you dry of technology, of patent rights, and of all the things that made you what you are, only so they can have short-term profits that they move away. Or am I seeing too much in this?
I don't think so, Rick. They're just going to pillage us for everything they can. They're also going to move some trucks from our sister plant, the Volvo plant, down in New River Valley, Virginia. They're gonna start taking their overflow trucks. It's just, we don't know where it's going to end. So right now, we're listed contractually as the primary facility for Mack trucks. And, you know, primary is what, 50% plus one. So unfortunately, it leaves open almost half our trucks being built down there if it should go that route.
So what's the response been from the members? I mean, you know, clearly you guys did win a really good contract, what I thought was a fair contract, and people were very happy. What seems to be the response now?
They're upset. You know, morale was pretty low to begin with, and now you just told us that we might be moving. Well, they're not moving. They're building a plant in Mexico. You know, I don't know how you fix that.
Is there anything politically that can be done? I mean, I know we've got a free trade agreement with Mexico where, you know, we don't slap tariffs on things coming across the border. Because I got to tell you, my first instinct is, look, you know, we want that stuff made here. I'm a firm believer in domestic production for domestic consumption and that we should have policies that encourage that. But with this free trade agreement, I don't know how we do that.
I don't know, but our local politicians are on board. Like, they're going to back us. We're looking into what we can do, and we're only a couple days into it. I'm sure we'll rally the troops for sure.
Have you gotten much public response from this? Because, and look, I know in the Lehigh Valley, again, Mack, while an iconic brand nationwide, like you said, built like a Mack truck, being a phrase that is everywhere, this place is special to the Lehigh Valley. Any response from folks there?
There's a lot of concern. We're the fourth largest employer in the valley. You know, we're pretty big. And there's a lot of stuff that people don't even think about. There's 2,500 of us. We all eat lunch somewhere. You know, all these small pizza shops and stuff, like, we're a pretty big part of their business. This could impact stuff locally, like, in more ways than just Mack trucks.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, there, again, I want to go back to the you guys got a reasonable contract. This wasn't an incredible, it wasn't everything everybody wanted, but it was a good contract. It was fair. How much of this, in your thought, is just I know you said it's about the cheap labor, but I got to think it's more about, you know, busting the union and being a bargaining tool down the road to ensure that you never get a fair contract again. That's got to be banging around in your head, too, as well, right?
Absolutely. So our last two contracts and Volvo's NRV contract, all three of them ended up in a work stoppage. And now here we are. They told us both, we're going to build your trucks down in Mexico. Now, it's hard not to think that way.
No, it is. So the response to that is, you know, how do you organize those workers in Mexico? Or does that even matter? Because the wages are so far different. The conditions, the labor standards, the environmental standards, all that are so far different. Does that matter?
Me, no, it doesn't. You know, this is it's more than just, you know, Mack trucks or Class 8 trucks. This is a problem with our country. Manufacturing jobs, once you reach a plateau, the company wants to pull it out from under you and just, we're going to go get it done cheaper somewhere else. You know, I hope we can be the rally cry for people to get behind us.
You know, The reason I think this is important and the reason I wanted to have you on is because I think this could be one of those moments where we're angry. And look, the one thing I give Trump credit for, back in 15 and 16, he was talking about reshoring manufacturing. He was talking about all those places that used to be, you know, Toledo, Ohio used to be the glass capital. You know, Clair, Wisconsin used to be the rubber capital. Akron, Ohio, rubber capital. There were places that used to be something because they built things. They had a good standard of living because of that. This seems to me to be something that could spark people going, yeah, that's it. And having local politicians saying, no, we're not giving you any more money when you move overseas. No, we're not going to support this kind of a move. Do you see this as potentially, are you considering this as a potential reaction of trying to get that spark, to get people to go, you know what, enough's enough already?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, we had a lot of local politicians reaching out to us already. Guy next door to me here, John Salco, he's very involved with our cap council, and our national cap council will get behind us on this. This isn't going to be taken lying down. We have all the tools to make this go political if that's the way we need to go.
Ultimately, I think it has to be. I think eventually working people in this country have to understand that they are all under, that we're all under attack. We're all in the shark tank. It's just a matter of, you know, when are we flavor of the month? And I think when we understand that we have power, when we understand, when we stand together in solidarity, that we can use that power to make these companies, if they're not willing to work together to make this country great, then we're going to have to force them along. And I got to tell you, at some point, I'm hoping there's that spark, and maybe this is it.
I hope so. You know, it was crazy. You know, I took office in January, and things seemed to be going well. You know, I was kind of meshing with the company. We're making big plans, and I don't know, it was all for nothing. It's just, they tell you what they think you want to hear, and I kind of feel played.
Yeah, no, and
this is a tough one, man.
No,
there's
feel
a lot
it.
Of people. Go ahead.
No, I feel it. I feel what you're saying, that this is a tough one. This is a slap in the face, considering, you know, you go back and I kind of understand the legacy of what Mac has had to go through over the last couple of decades. You know, there have been some concessions. There have been, you know, stagnant contracts to where you're trying to keep this company afloat, even when you have foreign companies come in and want to kill it off. And I still don't get this idea of constantly wanting to kill the golden goose that keeps making a great product, that does have an iconic image, that is bringing a steady return, not just for the shareholders and the company, but also for the community. It seems like the perfect relationship, only to have, well, now this.
They're definitely making money. Our ROE, return on equity, was 28.7%, which netted the average worker after a 6-week stoppage almost a $5,000 profit sharing check.
Wow.
So they're making money.
Yeah, but obviously they want that money for themselves. So last question I've got for you. What do we do? You know, I think I'm angry with you and for you and more angry for the country, because, again, we keep seeing this played out over and over and over again. And, yeah, this time it's going to be 2,500 workers potentially in Allentown. Who knows who's next? What do we do?
So, basically, we got to start supporting our local politicians that are labor-friendly. It's important to vote at the local level. I can't stress that enough. That's where a lot of this stuff is fixed. Buy American, you know, spend the extra couple dollars. I really don't know, because you don't know who's going to be next.
Yeah.
You don't.
I hear you. Tim, I appreciate you sharing some of this with us. I know this is tough, but I appreciate you taking time and sharing this with us. And I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on where things are and where things are going, because this to me is a big one.
Absolutely, man. We appreciate your time, Rick. It's, I know you do this for a passion. You know, it's not what you do to pay the bills. It's truly your passion. We appreciate it.
We're here for you, brother. Appreciate it. Again, keep me up to date. Tim Herzog, committee man and elected shop chair there at UAW Local 677. I want to hear your thoughts. When do we get tired of it? When do we say enough is enough and focus on, as I've been saying, domestic production for domestic consumption? We want our stuff built here by our friends, our neighbors, ourselves. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. That was the beginning of a 2-day rally in Washington, D.C. to protest the gathering of world leaders for the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or what is known as the A16 Summit. The event was a continuation of the massive protests that disrupted the World Trade Organization's meeting the year before in Seattle, Washington. The common thread through these protests was a concern over how globalization of world markets hurts working people and the environment. Protesters included a wide range of people, including peace activists, environmental activists, anarchists, and union members. 2 days before the D.C. protest, organizers held an international forum on globalization at the Foundry Methodist Church. 2,000 people attended this teach-in to hear from activists around the globe. It's estimated that 50,000 people attended the D.C. rallies. One big theme for the rallies was bringing attention to the negative consequences that can occur when developing countries receive economic bailouts. The strings attached to these painful bailouts often usher in destructive privatization schemes and painful austerity measures that disproportionately fall on the backs of working people. The protesters in the U.S. Capitol were met by a large police security presence. The D.C. police were determined that the protesters would not interrupt the meetings like they had done in Seattle. More than 1,000 people were arrested. These protests, from Seattle to Washington, D.C., demonstrate a growing recognition of the devastating impact globalization has on the lives of regular people. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, it's frustrating and it's angering all at the same time. I think about this, and it's the same thing with Harley. I mean, when Harley decided they were going to make some of their bikes over in China, infuriating. Because, again, you're killing the golden goose. You're taking what is an iconic brand, well-made, well-built, and, well, pushing for this idea of short-term gain, short-term profit. Hey, hooray for the shareholders, but screw the workers, the consumers, the communities, all that. And for too long, been getting away with it. And this is why I can't get it out of my head. August 19th, 2019, you may remember, before the pandemic, you had the business roundtable came out and said, you know what, we've learned our lesson. It's no longer only about maximizing shareholder wealth. It's no longer only about us. It's no longer only about squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams so we can line our pockets and load our accounts. No, no, we now care. Yeah, we care about those, what do they call those people that make this stuff? Oh yeah, workers. We care about them. And the people who buy it, we care about them too. Yeah, we care about them too. And also the communities that we're in, do we care about them? Well, okay. And that's what we were told. We were told that they learned their lesson. They can no longer kill the golden geese that built the most prosperous working class and economy in the history of civilization. They learned their lesson. And they were going to do better. They were going to be better because they now cared. And then the pandemic hits and they showed us that, well, not so much. Or actually, not at all. Which is why I look at what's going on over at Cleveland Cliffs, the steel producer. Their CFO, their CEO, gave a presentation to the workers last Friday, I believe it was. When he's saying, look, you know, you've got Nippon Steel, a Japanese firm that's attempting to acquire U.S. Steel. Again, another iconic American brand. And look, some bad history there, too. But built a very prosperous nation. And you're looking at Nippon, this Japanese company who wants access. They want to be here. They want to take over the market and control the steel producing aspects of our country. And look, we're capitalists, evidently, which is why the shareholders approved the $14.9 billion bid that Nippon put forth, because again, it's only about the money for the shareholders. It's about making me wealthier. About me. Now, I found it interesting that the CEO of Cleveland Cliffs said, "Look, yeah, it's not going to go through because," and I thought this was an incredible statement. Because of the CEO of U.S. Steel. He said, you know, they put the steel workers in an important position. And he said, look, my dear friend, Dave McCall, who is the president of the United Steel Workers, he said, he's the guy calling the shots right now. And he said, I'm glad I'm here with him. This is how I always say that union employer relationship should be, that it's a partnership. Look, you know, the company's got its wants, its needs. It's got to make a profit. It's got to comply with a bunch of stuff. It's got to make the shareholders happy. It's got to make management happy. But they also have to understand that the workers need to be able to make a living and be treated with dignity and respect. And the relationship that you see come out of this, and I'm hoping Cleveland Cliffs ends up acquiring U.S. Steel so that we have U.S. Steel production. In fact, it shouldn't even be allowed to happen, to have a Japanese firm own our steel capacity. And I've had people go, you know, it's not that much, only a small amount. Yeah, it's enough to go, look, we need steel making capacity. We need to be able to produce with the vital input of steel. And on a national security level, if you don't control that stuff, you're putting yourself in a really bad place. And, you know, I've yet to meet, and this is where this comes down to the divide And why I think, you know, Democrats to their peril have given up on a lot of working class voters, because working class voters get this. They get that if you lose your productive capacity, if they lose their jobs, the country becomes less stable, obviously less prosperous, and divided. Whereas our economic elites are folks who, well, you know, we don't need those dirty jobs. We'll just educate our way out of them. And the question I have is, how's that worked out for us so far? There are a lot of working people in a lot of working class communities that are still struggling. Now, as I've been saying, I think Biden is doing a good job in ensuring that we're making those places that used to be, making them the future. And I think that's a step, a start, a move in the right direction. But stopping the bleeding from the very beginning, that should be job one. And that is this. Don't allow U.S. Steel to be bought up by a foreign corporation. Start maybe thinking about, you know, this global tearing down of capital borders, this global tearing down of ownership. And I go, I know, oh, Rick, you're talking about isolation, being in isolation. No, I'm a protectionist. I believe there are things you need to protect. I don't care about T-shirts and tennis shoes and stuff like that. We can always make that. But this heavy industrial stuff, the inputs that go into that, the technology that go into it, I know we need to make our wealth class wealthier, and I know Monday was you know, Billionaire Appreciation Day, and they made a lot of their money off of selling out the American dream and selling out these corporations that did employ communities. But at some point, we, working people, have to say enough. Decide the old labor question, which side are you on? And we've been trained, like, amazingly so, to believe that somehow we identify with the shareholder class, with the investor class, because, you know, we've got a 401k that may have a couple of bucks in it, that we may have a retirement account that, you know, that is stock-based, that, you know, hey, that's my future, without understanding that those are pennies compared to the reality that once your job goes away, what are you going to do? And look, in 2022, we went to a lot of communities that had to grapple with that question and are still struggling with it. Decades after factories have left. Decades after that linchpin of the community was destroyed. So I go back to Allentown and Mack Truck. In what world do we say, yeah, it's a good thing to move production of that somewhere else? And I know I've had people say, well, you know, the consumer can decide. No, because we've seen this movie played out. If you remember, the Chevy Suburban was made in Janesville, Wisconsin. They opened up a plant in Mexico for overflow, you know, because, you know, we got so much demand. We needed that overflow. So eventually, I guess I should ask, folks of Janesville, Wisconsin, is that plant, that GM plant, still open? Oh, that's right. No, it's not. It hasn't been for a very long time. Makes me think of that guy with the big ears, you know, in the giant sucking sound. Yeah, all those jobs left because it wasn't about overflow. It was about breaking the unions up. It was about destroying that living wage. It was about destroying our families and our communities. And the sad thing is the business news, they don't focus on that. They focus on, you know, job return, you know, the number returned for the stocks and the Wall Street and the investors, how well they're doing. How many newspapers still have labor pages that tell the effect, the true effect of how these decisions affect communities? Now, those were killed off back in the late 70s because, you know, we can't have working people realizing that they're being fleeced. Especially at a time when they do such a great job of dividing us over nonsense. So I got to tell you, I'm hopeful that this might be that trigger. I'm hopeful that it may be the moment where we go, you know what? You know, Mack Truck is someone that we want to hold on to. It should be built here. We want to fight for those jobs. Want to hear your thoughts. email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast, or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, go to freespeech.org if you want to watch the video. Always there. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.